Well, let's talk a little bit about now. Where were we? What? Where do you get a title like that?
Oh, I don't know. It seems to me that we're at the end of the Reagan era now, and it's time to come out of the movie theater and blink in the light and figure out where we were when all this illusion arose. And so I figured I would call this book Now Where Were We, because it's full of pieces about the 80s and problems of the 80s and enthusiasms of the 80s, very few of which I joined in on. The 80s to me were a trashy decade, and but there are some things I think worth saving from the Reagan administration. For instance, the principle of plausible deniability, which you may recall the Reagan administration advanced as one of the justifications for lying during the Iran-Contra scandal. The way plausible deniability works is when an administration is accused of something, the administration says nothing could be further from the truth, which means we don't see any way you can prove it, at least not yet. And then if some more evidence comes out, they say, well, maybe a few things could be further from the truth, and there are various fallback positions you can work your way down to, all the way down to, well, at least there are no documents showing that the president ever showed his wife or something. And the great thing about that, I think, is that it ought to be extended, the right of plausible deniability, to all Americans, which would enable an American citizen, for instance, if the phone company called up and said, you haven't paid your phone bill in 2 months, you owe us $219, the person called could say, nothing could be further from the truth. And the phone company would be baffled and would say, what do you mean by that? And the American citizen could say, I think my words speak for themselves. And the phone company could say, now wait a minute, you've got a telephone, right? And the American citizen says, it's the first I've heard of it, it's news to me. And this is where you have to hang tough, because then the phone company will say, listen, now we're talking to you on your telephone, and what you have to do as an American citizen is say, that's your opinion. And if you hang in there, there are lots of phone companies out there, and you got a little play, and you can just tough it out. I've even written a little plausible deniability song.
You wouldn't want to sing it for us.
I would love to. I was hoping you would ask. Say you've been cheating on your diet, or you went out and started a riot. All you have to do is just deny it. Deniability. You don't have to have no humility if you've got deniability. And remember, you didn't hear it from me.
Hey, that's not bad at all. Write that yourself?
I wrote that.
Yep. You're not going to deny it.
I wrote it in the shower.
Let's go down some of the list of contents here and talk about some of the articles, essays that you've written here. I know you probably have some favorites, but the spa, the one about the spa, I myself had a spa, was interesting to me. Tell me a little bit about your experience with regard to the spa.
Well, I never expected to go to a spa, but a magazine called me up and asked me to go to Canyon Ranch Spa in Tucson, Arizona, to write something about it. And I thought, well, I would make fun of it. But then I got out there and...
You could have refused a tough assignment like that.
Yes, I know it. But I thought, well, I had been feeling like a pile of old leaves for a couple of years, and maybe I did need to be a little healthier. But I didn't expect to sell out to health, which is what I did. I got to the point where I was eating things. You know, I've always believed that it's wrong to eat things for an ulterior reason. You know, you should eat things, but if there's a barbecue sandwich and a carrot lying side by side, I mean, you could justify eating the carrot for ulterior reasons, which are that it would make you feel better. But on the other hand, the barbecue sandwich in and of itself is better, and also some pig gave up a lot for that barbecue sandwich, and you owe it to the pig. So I've always believed in eating that way, but I found at Canyon Ranch that eating things that weren't fried and weren't greasy actually made me feel better. And
now, don't you state very specifically that the chili dog is probably the world's greatest food?
Well, After I spent a week at this spa, living squeaky cleanly, I did go to the airport in Tucson and eat the best-tasting chili dog and drink the best-tasting beer I've ever had in my life, because I had been away from those things for a whole week. But I have modified my habits, I must admit. I have started eating better and exercising more, and it makes me feel kind of bad spiritually, but better physically. So there you are.
You went out to San Francisco for a while, I believe, while you were a guest columnist, weren't you, for the newspaper out there?
I was a guest columnist for the San Francisco Examiner for 2 weeks, and I got out there and wondered what a Georgian in San Francisco was obliged to write about. And it was right after the Supreme Court's decision, U.S. Supreme Court's decision on sodomy, in which it ruled that that homosexual sodomy was not protected by the law, that it was, you could get arrested for it, and laws outlawing it were okay. And that case arose from Georgia, as these things often do. Things outlawing things often arise from Georgia. So I felt that I should speak about sodomy, partly because the case that the Supreme Court case was based on, one of the precedents for this decision, was another Supreme Court decision called U.S. versus Stanley. This is a long story, but I covered that case way back in the 60s in Atlanta when I was working for a newspaper in Atlanta, and it included such wonderful, it was an obscenity case. This man had been arrested for having obscene matter in his house, which was a dirty movie. Mm. And it was one of the most entertaining cases I ever covered. Because
did you get to see the movies?
In fact, we did. And everybody,
probably several times.
Everybody in the courthouse showed up, and it was a striking thing because they dimmed the shades, dimmed the lights and lowered the shades, and all the lawyers in Atlanta happened to drop by. And they turned on this flickery, awful, smutty-looking movie, but it had a remarkable opening moment, a sort of sated-looking man lying on the floor hopped up into a bed with a woman. And it was an extraordinary thing. I never saw anybody move exactly like that. It opened with him lying out on the floor and the woman in bed, and he just leapt somehow up into the bed, and everyone was startled, until we realized that they were showing the movie backwards. They had forgotten to rewind it. And so they showed it forwards, and it was much less entertaining forwards, but it was the testimony from people espousing community standards was good. They interviewed people who had a judge. There was a community standards committee that had decided that this movie was obscene. And the members of the committee were asked questions like, are statues obscene, and are statues of nude people obscene? And the member of the community standards committee would say, well, certain parts of a nude statue are obscene. And
which parts was that person referring to?
Well, he was asked that, and he said, the lower parts.
So I can see that.
Yeah, we got down to the nitty-gritty in that case. So at any rate, it's a long, complicated thing leading to sodomy. But I came out, the thing is that sodomy is a term meaning that which is so loathsome that we people who are passing this law don't even have to tell you what it is. That's basically what sodomy means. So that it can be applied to most anything that people think is loathsome. And I think it's bad to have such a law.
But didn't you call for a National Sodomy Day?
I did. I did not call for it, but I said it's amazing to me that there is not one, since so many things that are legally sodomy are practiced widely. And, in fact, there is a nice lady named Dr. Ruth who even tells you how to do them on the radio. So, you know, in many states, lots of things that Dr. Ruth advises you on how to do are illegal. And so it surprises me that there's such a concept as sodomy.
What would one do on a National Sodomy Day, anyway?
Well, would probably spend a lot of time in reflection and perhaps leaping up into bed from the floor. I don't know. Listening to Dr. Ruth and then indulging in various forms of intimate necking.
Necking.
I don't know. I mean,
something like petting. Right?
The problem with sodomy is that it sounds dirty. You know, it's named for a biblical city. I went into the Bible in this in this essay on sodomy and looked up the whole thing about Sodom and Gomorrah. And the people of Sodom actually wanted to ravish some angels, which sounds terrible, and I don't approve of that. But and that's why anything loathsome tends to get blamed, called sodomy. But the Supreme Court, Warren Burger of the Supreme Court, actually said that he thought consensual homosexual acts were worse than rape. Now, that sounds to me pretty like a trashy opinion. Exactly the kind of thing that became fashionable in the 80s, saying things like that. Seems to me that anything people do because they want to is better than rape. So it seems to me that the practice of rape should be called sodomy, and that various things that come under the umbrella of sodomy now should be renamed for other cities. You could call them Dallasm or Friscality or Philadelphia or Wheeling. All sorts of new terms could arise.
Well, I guess the reader would be shocked to find out that there was so much explicit sexual content in Where Were We, huh?
Well, I hope if that reader is shocked, then it's not true. But if that reader is delighted, then it may well be true.
You have to start selling your stuff in brown paper wrappers.
Yeah, well, whatever works.
Well, let's go on a little bit. Why I Smell Like This. Can you tell me what this is all about?
Well, that's an account of an adventure in Bloomingdale's. I was asked by another magazine to go to Bloomingdale's men's fragrance department and write about it. Now, it seems to me that another thing that has developed in the 80s is the assumption that men need to look and smell nice. I've never really felt that way.
I haven't either. Why would somebody make that assumption?
I don't know. It's a kind of narcissism that has grown up among men, which seems to me a bad idea. It seems to me that the gender that once you start, you know, the great thing about being a man in the past has been you don't have to look good. And you can just sort of look passable and get along. And it's a terrible burden to have to look and smell nice all the time. And it's a burden that I did not intend to take on. So I went over there to see what it was like and found that not only was the men's fragrance department a phantasmagoria of weird scents, but that there were actually people standing along in the aisles of Bloomingdale's spraying things on me. You know, I don't like to shop. I once knew a woman who filled out a questionnaire which asked her what her hobbies were, and she said her hobbies were crying and shopping. Now, I will cry when I have to, but I really hate to shop, except for groceries. I like to shop for groceries, partly because nobody in a grocery store comes up and tries to poke food into your mouth or anything. But at Bloomingdale's, they squirt scents on you, which I resisted and resented. And the scents have strange names. There was one. There was some woman trying to get me to try some perfume named that was spelled P-O-I-S-O-N, poison. And I said, "Why would you name a perfume poison?" And she said, "Oh no, it's not poison. It's poisson. Poisson. That's French for I don't know."
Poison.
Yeah, all right. That's what I said. I said, "Are you sure it's not P-O-I-S-S-O-N, which I happen to know is French for fish?" She said, "No, it's poison, which means, I've forgotten, attractive lady or something like that." Well, I wasn't buying that for a minute. But in the men's thing, they have, you know, there's this obsession for men. You know those ads of people. Now, I've just come out in favor of allowing people to feel free to express themselves physically, but on the other hand, there are those obsession ads which try to get you to smell a certain way so that you will find yourself in a tangle of an odd number of naked limbs, which nobody can tell one limb from another. I mean, it's hard, you know, those ads for Obsession, which show about seven people and 11 legs tangled together, and nobody knows whose leg is which.
That's you don't even know if they're male or female.
You don't. That's right, and I think that's going a bit far. And there were such, you know, the actual scent that is supposed to inspire that sort of thing was on sale in Bloomingdale's.
And you passed that up.
And I passed it up, but I did find out what the key ingredient is. You may be interested in knowing this. I grilled the salesman there, and finally they broke down and told me that the key ingredient in Obsession is vanilla.
That's scary, isn't it?
I know it.
Well, I'm going to stick with the minin that I get at Woolworths.
Right.
Or maybe
some in a green jar.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
Slap it on. Right.
At Christmas time, I do go a little higher. I get Old Spice.
Right.
But that's about my limit. Well, let's see. What else are we going to talk about here? Well, I suppose since you have the picture of the Founding Fathers on the front of the dust jacket, we ought to talk about your place among the Founding Fathers.
Well, I'd be happy. I would be happy to do that. I was asked to write something about...
How come you're always asked?
I don't know. It's a wonder to me.
Nobody asked me to do anything.
Well, I know. At least I keep being afraid somebody's going to start telling me to do something. But they asked me to go to... not go anywhere, but to imagine what it would have been like had I been at the Constitutional Convention where the U.S. Constitution was written and what I would have said. Now, this was a good opportunity for me because my ancestor, William Blunt, who was the first governor of Tennessee, was actually at that Congressional Convention, and various books about that convention describe William Blunt in, well, for instance, one book summed up all the members, signers of the Constitution as generally an impressive group. There were a couple of geniuses and several very prominent, you know, memorable leaders and some brave men, and actually only one outright scoundrel, who was, in fact, my ancestor, William Blunt. He was called that because he tried to organize war between England and Spain so that, in order to protect his real estate investments in New Orleans, which at the time, I mean, in Louisiana, which at the time belonged to Spain, I guess. And he was a real estate man. That's another 80s thing. My ancestor was into real estate well before the 1980s, I guess the 1780s, he said there is a continent for sale, and he was going to try to sell it, get hold of it, and then sell it. So his motives at the Congressional Convention were not too high, and I thought it would be useful to go. And I didn't want to go back. I was afraid he would pull me over and say, listen, I want you to talk to a couple of the boys here. We've got some things working that I think you ought to be in on. I was afraid that I would be, you know, implicated by my... you know, they would think that one Blunt was just like another. So I thought that I would jump off early and say several things like no nation can long survive half slave and half free, which would, one thing that would get me in ahead of Lincoln, you know, therefore it would get me into Bartlett's familiar quotations. I would be in Bartlett's familiar quotations even before I was born, which I found, you know, it'd been great to put in your college application that, when I was trying to get into college, if I could say that I was in Bartlett's familiar quotations.
And think of the royalties year after year in Bartlett's.
Right, that's right, all those dollars coming in. But and also it would ease the pressure on a Southern white person who's always trying to prove that he's not on the wrong side of everything, if I could point to the fact that I was against slavery back in 1787. It would also help me in interviewing basketball players today. Also, I was going to mention that at the Congressional Convention that there was no mention of women, you know, that I think we ought to put something in here about women. And, of course, everybody would be grumbling about me and think of me as a loose cannon, but And it would probably be awkward at the time, but later on it would stand me in good stead. I think it would be a feather in my cap if I happened to meet a woman to be able to tell her that she was able to vote because of my activity at the Congressional Convention, Constitutional Convention.
Well, all I can say, Roy, it's too bad you weren't there.
I know it. I know it. It's taken us years to get over the fact, centuries to get over the fact that I was not there.
Well, let's talk about one or two other items. You, I suppose we ought to talk about whiskey, huh?
Well, whiskey's good, yeah.
Yeah, it is.
It is. It's another problem about the 80s is that people have soured on whiskey. Which, I mean, I'm not denying that there are reasons to criticize whiskey. It has caused a lot of bad things to happen. On the other hand, I have a lot of fond memories of it, and I certainly don't want to drink so much of it that I will have to quit drinking it, but I still like to have a little bit every now and then. And in that piece, I talked about the best whiskey I ever had and the worst whiskey I ever had. And the worst whiskey I ever had was after going on a coon hunt with a man. I had been told by Sports Illustrated that there was a man in Florida who had a remarkable hunting dog, coon hunting dog. This was some years ago, and I don't remember what was remarkable about the dog at the time, but I thought I would check it out, so I went out into the woods with this man and his son, Forrest, who was a teenage son who didn't really want to go coon hunting and was griping and saying he didn't want to go out in the woods, and his father was urging him on, so he was trying to keep Forrest happy and also impress this writer from Sports Illustrated with his dog. And his dog proceeded to tree a possum and a house cat, which, if you've ever been around coon hunters, you know is just horrible. So we went back, and Forrest at that point just left and went home, and so the man and I walked back and sat down on his front porch, and I told him I'd come back some other time when the weather was better, but we both knew that I wouldn't, and I thought to myself that I had never quite had such a bad night as he had just had in front of crucial witnesses, but someday I probably would. And he brought out a bottle. It was an old syrup bottle that had a cork in it, and he said, "There's no treasury stamp on this," meaning that it was homemade whiskey.
It was clear.
Well, it wasn't. That's the thing. It wasn't White Lightning because it wasn't quite clear. It was sort of yellowish. I don't know why. It had a kind of corny taste to it, and it was certainly, or some kind of odd taste to it, and it was a little bit sweet, and it was certainly harsh, and it was pretty good.
That was the best?
That was the worst whiskey.
Well, that was the worst. Yeah, still, that's right. That's kind of like sex, though. Yeah. Even bad sex is good.
That's right.
And the best?
Well, the best was something called Macallan's Royal Wedding that I had. It was a scotch that was, a single malt scotch from the birth year of Princess Di and a single malt scotch from the birth year of Prince Charles were blended together into a royal wedding scotch that I've never had much use for royalty before, but if they can make whiskey like that, I can see a purpose for them, after all.
Well, you have a phenomenal memory. How do you remember all of these stories? You
know,
I
don't know. I'm surprised.
At random, yeah. And you just go on. And
frankly, I'm surprised. I'm making some of it up, but
well, you pick another one or two that you to talk about.
Well, in the course of working my way up to writing about sodomy in San Francisco, I wrote about a couple of other things. I kept saying, I'm going to write about sodomy because I feel it's my duty to write about sodomy. But first, I want to say a few other things. I talked about restaurants along the way. San Francisco, another big thing in the 80s was restaurants. San Francisco is particularly a big restaurant town. I went, while I was there, to any number of restaurants, and I proposed several new restaurants that might well crop up pretty soon. One was called Ferns Galore, in which you get your salad gradually and naturally as it drifts down into your plate from overhead because there's so many ferns in pots. There's another place called Over the Sink, where each diner gets a sink for eating over and a faucet for drinking out of and a dishcloth for tidiness, and one of the specialties of that place would be probably a bacon, tomato, mayonnaise, mustard, pimento cheese sandwich on cheap white bread. Then there's another restaurant called La Carte, where the descriptions of the fare is so mouthwatering that what they do is they bring you several dishes to the table, and if you can guess what they are, then you get to read the menu.
By the way, how's Minkin doing?
Minkin, oh, you know that I have a cat named Minkin? Oh, Minkin, I know you.
Minkin the cat.
Minkin the cat. How did you know I had a cat named Minkin?
Well, I have my spies out.
My goodness. Well, I know you're a Minkin enthusiast. I went to the home of H.L. Minkin in Baltimore, and while I was there, the curator was in the back room. He showed us around, told us to look around, and then he went to the back room, and on our way out, we stopped by to say hello, and he had this stray cat in there who had just showed up on the doorstep of the Minkin house, and it was a cute little thing, and so I adopted it. He was looking for a home for it. Took it back to New York, and took it back and forth between New York and Mill River, my two places of residence, and it's a great flexible cat, but then I broke up with the lady I was living with and was living alone with Minkin, and Minkin was very demanding, and I must say that I just found Minkin a home in my niece Audrey's apartment. My niece Audrey works for American Logger magazine, and I actually went to visit Minkin last night. You can't see this on the radio, but Minkin greeted me by scratching me as usual.
Yeah, they don't forget, and they don't forgive.
Right. Well, she scratched me a lot when she was living with me too, but she was a good cat, but I kept trying to think if she was anything like H.L. Minkin. She was, sort of abrasive, as he was in his writing. But, Minkin published something called The Great Bathtub Hoax. My cat, Minkin, was fascinated with bathtubs. I don't know why, but she would get into bathtubs and play around and play around and play around. Even while you were taking a shower, there would be a rustle in the curtain, and Minkin would be between the outer curtain and the inner curtain and actually would get wet. She liked getting wet, and she loved bathtubs. And, in fact, I never realized this until Audrey, my niece, took Minkin over. But Audrey has reported to me that Minkin, in fact, relieves herself, pees in the tub, and goes right over the drain and instead of using the kitty litter, which...
Audrey's going to have to keep the bathtub half filled up.
Well, I know it, but there's a
Minkin
feeling...
Minkin has developed some bad habits.
I know it. I think... I don't know whether H.L. ever did anything that course.
No, I don't think H.L. ever did. I wrote a book about...
I know you did.
...Minkin
yeah.
not so long ago. But you have an advantage that I didn't have. I never saw the inside of his house.
You never went? It's yeah. It's an interesting place to go.
It was only open to the public, I think, about 2 or 3 years ago.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. It was a... I worked in Baltimore at the CBS television affiliate there, the house was closed, and it was owned by the University of Maryland, which I think at one point made it a nurse's dormitory.
Oh, yeah?
But I would drive by it, yeah. And I always wondered what it looked like inside.
Well, it's a nice old row house. It's got all of his liquor cabinet is there, all the liquor he had. And oddly enough, on his desk, which is supposedly preserved as it was when he died, there is a Gideon Bible. I thought that was nice. He kept it by his side, perhaps for rhetorical reasons.
Well, you know, Minkin used to steal these Gideon Bibles from hotel rooms. Mm. And he would give them to his friends, and he would sign... Inside, he signed with the compliments of the author.
Oh, maybe that's why he had one. Then. Yeah.
I just got a letter last week from some guy who runs the Minkin Society in Baltimore, who had read my book and found an error.
There you go. Yeah.
But at the same time, invited me to speak for the Minkin Society.
That's good.
I feel very awkward doing that since I'm only a buff. You know, I'm not
only
these guys
a buff.
Are scholars.
Oh,
these guys are scholars down there. One guy. Having an autograph party next week, I got a little notice in the mail. He's just written a brand new biography of Minkin, so these guys know their stuff.
The difference between buffs and scholars is that buffs have more fun.
That's true, and if you make a mistake, you can say, well, I'm just a buff.
That's right.
You're going on a nationwide tour, huh?
Yes.
What's that like?
Well, it's lots of one-night stands in hotel rooms, and you're clothes get nastier and nastier, and you...
Don't you have valet services in these...
Well, you know, well, if you're there overnight, you can have your clothes done, but if you just... I mean, if you're... You know, you have to get it in by 9 o'clock one morning in order to have it done the next day. So if you're not there till 2, I mean, it's hard to do it in one day. So that's a constant struggle to keep up your appearance so that you will not be barred from radio stations. I mean, you have to look pretty awful not to get into a radio station, but I can imagine it happening because I tend to sit on my... I mean, my clothes tend to get wrinkled within about 5 minutes after I put them on anyway. So within 3 weeks, they get pretty bad. And I don't check baggage. I do not check baggage. There are several things I don't do. One of them is check baggage because they lose it. And, for instance, this is not widely known, but baggage handlers play something called the carousel game. When you go down to the luggage place to get your luggage, there is a wall there, you know. You can't see the baggage handlers, and you see your luggage eventually coming up on this carousel, this conveyor belt thing that goes round and round. What the baggage handlers are doing back there on the other side of the wall, there's a little hole, and they look through the hole, and they wait till everybody's gathered around the carousel, and then they wait a while longer, and they wait a while longer, and then they start to, well, then they go take a break and go to lunch, and then they come back, and people have been milling around the carousel for a long time, and then they start playing the carousel game, which is, they try to figure out which bag belongs to which person, and they bet on it, you know. And so if somebody thinks a bag belongs to the last person on the outer fringes of the mob trying to get at the carousel, he will put that bag out first. He'll throw that one out and see whose bag it is and watch everybody fight for a while, and if he wins, he gets to do it again. And gradually they throw out a bag, and then they figure out who's getting the people who are about to faint and the people who are about to fight. They try to guess which bags belong to those people, and of course they keep those bags till the last minute. It must be fun back there for them, but I don't like to sit through it on the other end of it, so I never check baggage. So that means I cannot take many clothes on the road. So
you wouldn't have this baggage game problem if you took Eastern Airlines.
I wouldn't have any problem at all. That's right. I wouldn't have to go on tour.
Do you get an escort, an official escort?
Well, my official escort comes in. I mean, there are various escorts along.
Is Sally going?
Will be on part of it. She's already been on part of it. I've been out to California. She was there.
Sounds like a real tough job.
Yeah. Well, there's a great institution actually called Escort Services, which is not what it sounds like.
It's called Oriental Escort Service.
In each city, there is an outfit of people, mostly women, mostly housewives, or retired people. I mean, older people or something. But it's a great job for people who like to drive authors around, or who are willing to drive authors around, because they just, rather than have a limo service or having to take cabs, you have this nice person who knows where all the radio stations is, and she takes you from radio station to radio station and commiserates with you and tells you and gossips to some extent about other authors she has known. Usually they're very close-lipped, but they will tell you which authors are terrible people, which is a useful thing to know.
Yeah, I'd like to know that.
I'm sworn not to divulge it.
I was amused a year or two ago. Robert Ludlum was to do an interview, but before the interview, he had a book signing over at Barnes & Noble.
Mm.
And he was very late. He was 20, 25 minutes late getting here. And the reason was his limousine got stuck in traffic. Of course, Barnes & Noble is 2 blocks away, you know. But they insisted on putting him in the limousine, you know.
Yeah.
You know what it's like in Midtown Manhattan. So I could have suggested that he just get out of the cab. He could have been here in 2 minutes.
Yeah, well, he's a blockbuster author, and he needs to...
That's right.
Right in the blockbuster
car. He needs his
car.
Perks.
That's right.
Well, Roy, I guess we could go on talking forever, but I know you're anxious to get your tour underway.
Oh, yeah.
By the way, you bump into Garrison?
I saw Garrison yesterday. I had lunch with him, and he's doing fine. He's got a book out very soon himself, and I suppose I have no hope of outselling it, but perhaps...
Well, it's not a race, not a competition.
Well, not to you.
Roy Vaughn, Jr., thank you very much.
Thank you, Don.